My father's voice was agitated. There are too many of us, and people will stare. Who knows what will happen? Do you know how they treat me at the factory? Do you know how they laugh at me? What will happen when they see so many of us? This was the menace of knowing. I didn't understand the anxiety that my father felt, but I eventually would. That was my inheritance. The anxiety of being stared at. Maybe someone would walk past our table and tell us to go back to our country. Maybe they would be rude to us. Maybe they wouldn't serve us. He didn't want to subject us to that, and in the driver's seat of the Pontiac, ushered us through the timeless tradition of the drive-thru. Out of sight at the drive-thru, we were like everyone else. That is, until we spoke into the intercom. The car thrummed as we pulled up to the illuminated speaker, which crackled and barked, haloed in the translucent glow of all the holy glories that McDonald's had to offer. My dad had to repeat his order several times, and he started each time with, "Hello, how are you? I would like 3 cheeseburger, 2 Big Mac, 3 fen fry. No, 3. 3. Yes, fen fry. No, thank you. Yes, thank you." I repeated our order from the back seat with perfect clarion enunciation. The aroma of beef tallow fries and hamburgers warmed the car, and as my Uncle Ty held the bags next to me, my father called back to us, "Save the container for the Big Macs, okay? We could use them for sandwiches for your school lunches." After dinner, we washed and rinsed the yellow styrofoam containers carefully and set them on the drying rack. At lunch the next day, I pulled out a pale yellow Big Mac container from my lunch bag, laying it next to a banana and the pint of milk that was handed out to everyone. Craig crowed his approval. "Holy moly, you got a Big Mac for lunch. You are so lucky." Other kids chimed in, amplifying the chorus of approval. I beamed. Then I pulled out a cheese sandwich, a homemade one, not even grilled. The table's waves of envy reversed into a riptide of laughter as I held my sandwich over the opened clamshell container, the supposed pearl of a McDonald's sandwich now, in reality, just a square of cheese pushed between 2 slices of white bread. I ate it wordlessly, staring at the Big Mac container with disgust. Amid the laughter, Sean asked if there was really a banana in my banana, and the jokes rolled on from there. Was there really milk in my milk? I had thought that my parents, in their thrift, were ingenious for reusing the McDonald's packaging, but no one else did, at least no one at Moreland Elementary School. My admiration for the package soured, and from that point on, whenever my mom packed my lunch in a Big Mac container, I would break it, purposefully pushing my thumb through the top or snapping the clasp so that my parents wouldn't use them anymore for my lunches. "I guess these aren't as good as they look." My mother tossed another one in the trash. My father scratched his chin. "That's strange. Mine has been fine for months. I think Fope is just too rough with them. I can keep using them. Just give him a plastic bag." My father continued using the styrofoam containers, a small bit of scrimping so that his son could be spared the ignominy of it and be like everyone else. That was the delusion. We weren't like everybody else. I now had the menace of knowing, and it infected everything I did. I was reminded of it constantly in ways large and small. My parents' wobbly accents as my English became arrow straight, the long and confusing searches in the grocery stores for simple items, the stares from strangers at the mall. These reminders that my family was not a normal American family, that we didn't look like the rest of our town, that we were from somewhere else, wove into my very fabric a need to belong, a need that was a glittering and slippery yarn. I would never be able to untangle it from who I was and who I wanted to be, and it seemed that if I tugged on this thread, everything would unravel and leave me exposed. Chapter 2. Crime and Punishment. Violence, physical violence, simmered as an unstable agent in my family's chemistry. Parents spanked and beat their kids. Siblings struck one another. Cousins punched cousins. Grandparents smacked their grandkids. Pillow fights turned into fist fights. Am I missing anything? I had no reference for what was normal. Behavior that I now, in adulthood, recognize as excessive I accepted wholesale as a child. My family's thermodynamics were volatile and explosive, but this was our reality. Violence and the threat of violence darkened the rosy tint of childhood. Sometimes, violence settled disputes, and sometimes, it splintered into more problems. It was how my family expressed their feelings of anger and disappointment, and even love. They beat us because they cared for us, because they loved us, because they beat us. Maybe you were the victim of violence. Maybe you were the perpetrator. Maybe you were just an innocent bystander. At some point in the Tran family, you would be all three. The Troika. Violence lashed Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment to my childhood. The violence of Dostoevsky's world is woven throughout Crime and Punishment, stitched into the very language of the novel's narrative. In his tale about a desperate college student who murders two helpless women, Dostoevsky plunges his reader into a paranoid world where violence hangs thick in the air. The violence and assault of his raw imagery, feverish and unyielding, is indelible. This was a world I knew from experience, a world I had grown up in, a world where violence was potentially everywhere. November 1979. I was in Ombawai's apartment, watching a rerun of Land of the Lost, when I heard my grandmother yelling at my Uncle Tai, who was 10 at the time. All kids take great interest in the woes of other children, so I immediately abandoned the world of sleestacks and stop-motion dinosaurs to peer around the corner from the safety of the living room. My grandmother was berating Tai, whose nose was bleeding. His black hair, in an asymmetrical bowl cut, was yanked up and disheveled. My grandmother was apoplectic, having amassed unstoppable momentum. "That bike was a gift. Why didn't you take care of it? Do you know how nice the hooks were to give you that bike? And now you lose it?" The timbre of her voice peaked at a fervid pitch. Wearing oversized rose-colored bifocals, Bawai, my grandmother, reigned as the undisputed heavyweight champion of the Tran family. At 47 years old, she had birthed 10 kids over 2 decades, displaying a will and a uterus of iron. With her black hair in a bun, she powdered her face to lighten her already fair complexion, and her blush, which was actually lipstick rubbed in light circles on her cheeks, gave her a carnival visage. Every morning, Bawai drew thin eyebrows on herself, penciling them slightly higher than her natural brow line. Her high brows gave her a look that, depending on the occasion, signaled alertness, alarm, or surprise. At that moment in her vexation, the high brows gave her an irrumpent intensity. She was not looking for a judge's decision. She was in the ring to knock someone out. Bawai's ire wasn't the anger of personal damages, but the anger of being shamed, a singular dishonor that she and my parents bore heavily. If our elders felt that we kids had done something to embarrass them or to cause them to lose face, our punishment was administered as if the entire town were watching and judging them as parents. Puritanical in its purity and unflinching in its deliverance. The severity of our punishment was commensurate to their own perception of their parenting. That is to say, the worse you were beaten or punished, the better they seemed to be as parents. Tai tried to explain, "I didn't lose it. Some kids beat me up and took it. That's not losing it." He offered the explanation, and crack, Bawai slapped him across the face. "Don't interrupt me." She punctuated her reminder with another savage blow. Tai's already bloody face now bore the pale imprint of her hand, reddening against his cheek. She continued with a withering dismantling of my uncle, who avoided eye contact for fear of another blow. Her every utterance struck the point about how it was an embarrassment to the family. Jolted by the hard slap that she meted out to my uncle Tai, I made an indelible mental note. Do not ever interrupt Bawai unless I wanted to be slapped. She stormed out of the room, still the defending champion. Bawai, undefeated record. Tai went outside to sit on the apartment steps. Two of Tai's older brothers, Jung, who was 21, and Ji, who was 18, followed him. I slipped along behind them, abandoning Land of the Lost altogether. Real drama. trumped fake drama. I knew better than to speak. That was the first rule of being one of the younger kids. Talking out of turn got you a punch in the shoulder or a blow across the back of the head. Ty wiped the blood from his nose, the imprint of his mother's hand still pulsing on his left cheek, a ruddy reminder for us all of the matriarch and her unquestioned authority. "What happened?" G comforted Ty. "I was riding around the cemetery and some kids knocked me off my bike and took it. They told me to go back to my country." I was bewildered by the details of his story. "You could just take something from someone by hitting them? A complete stranger could just walk up to you, hit you, and take your bike? How did you get your bike back then?" The second part of Ty's story was equally baffling. Go back to your country. What did that even mean? What country? The one we had lost? That made as much sense as telling us to run back inside a burning building because we weren't welcome outside. The import of it, the insult of it, was lost on me, and selfishly I was much more terrified of the first proposition, the bike stealing. Shameless theft without consequence was horrific to consider. Ji and Chung Vietnamesed with each other quietly and then turned to Ty. "Let's go look for your bike." "Really?" Ty straightened up. "Yeah, Phup, you stay here." I didn't argue with G, knowing my low place in the hierarchy. My three uncles headed off in the direction of the Molly Pitcher Cemetery, a block away, where Ty had been riding his bike. The cemetery's stone-hewn wall was visible from the top of the apartment steps, so I stood, watching and waiting. I pondered the idea of random strangers taking things from us. How could I protect myself from it? Did these people look a certain way? What distinguished the nefarious strangers from the benevolent ones? My thoughts did lapse on the short track of kinder logic as I looked past the parking lot toward the cemetery. After half an hour, I saw my three uncles walking back from the cemetery, and as they got closer, I noticed that Ji's face was flush, Jung seemed disheveled, and Tai's crimson nosebleed flashed red. They weren't speaking to one another, and their sluggish pace suggested defeat. But as they got closer, instead their stride strengthened with an air of confidence, defiance even. It was not the limp of defeated boys. I saw that Ty's stolen bike was being pushed between Ty and Jung. They had taken it back from the other kids, their knuckles bloodied and faces mottled. Violence had counterbalanced violence. Maybe violence could exact justice, and even if it wasn't justice, at least violence could recover what was lost. And even if winning wasn't justice, it still felt better than losing. Maybe violence could make things right. Lou perched at the kitchen table, drinking from a sippy cup. I seized the cup from him to drink some of his juice, a deprivation that immediately caused him to shriek. "Phup, stop it! I'm trying to cook!" My mother stormed over, wrenched the sippy cup from my hands, and gave it back to Lou. "Leave him alone." My mother, 28 years old, barely 5 feet tall, with long jet black hair that cascaded to her waist, delicate features, fair complected, and large dark eyes that were emphasized by the striking frame of her hair. Her hands were hardly larger than mine, and her wedding band wobbled loose on her finger. Her eyes always had clouds of worry lingering at their edges, regardless of whether she was laughing or crying. Worry that I assume sprung from having a child at 22, fleeing Saigon at 24, having another child at 25 after a difficult pregnancy, and receiving a cancer prognosis shortly thereafter. Of course, I didn't leave Lou alone. I grabbed the sippy cup and pinched him on the arm before running around the corner. It wasn't even a matter of my wanting a drink now. I felt like pinching my little brother. I was shrieking and yelling as I ran around the apartment when my mother marched around the corner and grabbed the cup again. "I said stop it!" It was a game now. Game on. I could smell rice boiling over and charring on the stove. "Look what's happening now," she yelled as she noticed the rice pot clanking and clacking. My mother's worst profanity was "Jaidukai." Oh my heavens. I could hear her muttering "Jaidukai" under her breath as I made a third attempt at pilfering Lou's sippy cup. I snatched the cup and sprinted to my bedroom. Victory. I could hear my brother crying again as I hid, giggling. The juice was all but gone, but I chewed on the hard plastic top, too busy to care or notice. I didn't even see the blow coming. A burst of white flashed in my eyes like a camera bulb, and a dull burn seared the left side of my head, near my eye. My mother had rolled up a magazine, and with her improvised cudgel, she had struck me as hard as she could on the left side of my head. Thwack! "Give Lou back the cup! Jaidukai!" Her blow capitalized the seriousness of her demand. Game over. She snatched the cup from me, grousing while she stomped back to the kitchen to cook. In the woozy wake of the blow, I held my head and wept on the bedroom floor until my mother barked at me for dinner. When I rounded the corner into the kitchen, I sniffled an apology, my chin and cheeks still dripping with tears. She turned around and let out a sharp cry. "Jaidukai! Jaidukai!" I thought I was in trouble again and flinched, but she cupped my face and she herself began crying. She was crying? Her hands were covered in blood. A lot of blood. My blood. I didn't know that I was bleeding. The rolled-up magazine had split my temple, next to my left eye, and there gaped a large, 2-inch gash. My mother sobbed. "I'm so sorry. Oh, Fop, I'm so sorry." I winced as she wiped a cold washcloth over the cut. Wiping. More wiping. Still more wiping. Then some quick triage. A band-aid was applied to my head, brief and tender. My father was still working second shift at the factory, so my mother and I shared our meal in silence as Lou babbled on. The side of my head pulsed under the band-aid. Later that night, as she tucked me into bed, my mother inspected the gash once more and stroked my cheek. "I'm so sorry, Fop. I'll never hit you again. Never." It was, in fact, the last time that my mother ever struck me. The first time? The first time is lost in the fuzziness of a child's recall and the blur of so many other assailants. As my mother now tells this story, the scar along my left eye is a constant reminder, an ever-present censure of the lasting harm that a moment's anger could inflict. She tells this story as her own cautionary tale. But it's not the scar, whose small crease is still visible decades later, that I remember the most. It's her apology. The only apology that I ever received from someone for striking me. The only apology ever. 1980. Do kids know whether they're rich or poor? Do rich kids know that they grow up without any wants or needs? That they get everything they desire? What about poor kids? I can tell you that I knew we were poor early on. I knew that I was wearing discarded clothing that someone had donated to us. I knew what no meant when I asked for a $2 Han Solo action figure at the store. It meant we didn't have enough money for it. Like the violence I lived in, our poverty had no context. Adults like to say that kids are resilient, and that's true, but it's because they don't know anything different. Kids are kids, and their ignorance allows them to accept things as they are. That's their resilience. Bawai and I were at Willow Street Variety, a small, locally owned grocery store in town that carried a limited selection of produce. I had tagged along because the grocer had a spinning rack of comic books, which I perused while my grandmother basketed milk, sugar, and butter. By the comic books, fluttered magazines, newspapers, and small cardboard boxes of trading cards. I chose to look at an issue of Captain America, skipping over the trading cards, which feted players whose names I didn't know, excelling in games whose rules I didn't understand. But then, looking up from Captain America, I saw the unmistakable image of Darth Vader emblazoned on a waxy yellow Topps package among the trading cards. "See you later, Cap'n. The dark side is calling me." I picked up two packages and felt the rectangular silhouette of gum on the obverse side. I held them to my nose to inhale the powdery sweetness. Star Wars trading cards. Surely we could afford them. "Bawai, can we buy this?" It was 25 cents per pack. "No, we can't. We have just enough money to buy butter and cooking oil." I didn't realize that we were buying groceries with food stamps, nor did I know what food stamps were. "What about just one pack?" I begged, stunned that we didn't have even 25 cents. "No, put them back. We have to go home now." I walked back to the rack of mustachioed sports heroes, and as I approached the cards, I cast aside my caution and morality. I slid the two Star Wars packets into the waistband of my shorts. If I'd known the expression, fuck it, at that age, I would have said it. My magnetic love of Star Wars redirected my spinning moral compass, forcing the arrow to point toward Darth Vader. I continued to walk casually past the Topps display and met my grandmother at the counter where she was finishing her transaction. Are you ready to go, folk? Yep. We held hands on the walk home as I felt the waxy packets rubbing against my sides under my shorts. I harbored no remorse for the theft, looking forward only to opening up the cards as soon as I could. When we got to my grandparents' apartment, my grandmother went to the kitchen to make lunch. I sat behind the couch because hiding behind the couch was the extent of my criminal master plan and opened the trading cards. Grand Moff Tarkin, C-3PO, Sand People. I examined the cards and flipped them over. Some cards had trivia on the back, others were parts of a larger jigsaw puzzle, while others had behind-the-scenes details. I popped both pieces of trading card gum into my mouth, chewing them into stiff, saccharine shards. I fanned the cards out to look at them further, any guilt that I might have felt about stealing them being quickly detruded by my delight of having 24 trading cards. I would be the envy of my class, I thought as I looked over my booty. The gum and salivation made me thirsty, and I went to the kitchen to get water. My grandmother heard me chewing loudly. What are you eating? She asked, her eyebrows raised as high as they could go. Not good. What? Gum. I could see things were going to end badly. Where did you get gum? From the, oh boy. She barreled into the living room and saw the trading cards strewn across the floor behind the couch. I winced, their discovery heralded by yelling and screaming. I didn't know most of the words she was saying in Vietnamese, a harbinger of worse things to come. Her eyebrows twitched. I remembered Uncle Ty, and I braced myself for her trademark right hook across the face. You stole the cards? You stole them? Do you know what will happen if you get caught? They'll send us all back to Vietnam. That's what they will do. This made no sense to me, so I started to speak. For stealing trading cards? Really? Apparently, I had forgotten the grave motto of not interrupting Bawai. My impudent retort hurled my grandmother over reason's edge. She grabbed my ear in the sharp pincers of her index finger and thumb and pulled me into the kitchen, my whole body stuck in the tractor beam of her grip. We had stopped at the kitchen counter, and I heard the drawers clanging open and jangling shut until she released my ear. Put out your hands, she demanded. What? I said put out your hands, in front of you, palms down. I didn't want to get slapped in the face, so I complied. Hands out in front of me, palms down. What was she going to? Crack! A blinding pain shot through my fingers and knuckles as my grandmother shrieked in Vietnamese. One! She struck my outstretched hands with the handle end of heavy garment scissors. I started screaming immediately in alarm and pain. At least she held the scissors safely with the pointed end in her fist. Be quiet and keep your hands out. I'm counting to 10. I put my hands behind myself, but she grabbed me by the ear again. Do you want me to count to 20? No. Tears cascading, hands slowly stretching out. My diminutive grandmother, high brows on high alert, scissors in hand, counted from 2 to 10, each number punctuated by a hard rap on my knuckles, which reddened and split. In between each number, she yelled variations of, "They'll send us all back to Vietnam if they catch you." It was a searing eternity until the number 10 arrived, snapping with one last hard rap on my bleeding knuckles, the scissors and the number clacking in a painful two-part harmony. Now go kneel in the corner. Kneeling in the corner was Vietnamese timeout, and I had knelt in every corner of the apartment. You knelt on the floor with your hands crossed in front of yourself, facing inward in the corner, sometimes for minutes, sometimes closer to an hour. If, however, you were especially naughty or deserved a timeout deluxe, you would kneel on uncooked grains of rice. Yes, hard grains of rice. In the first few minutes of kneeling on them, the rice would feel sharp and uncomfortable, but after 10 or 15 minutes, They needled into your kneecaps, growing keener the longer you knelt. If you got kneeling in the corner on rice, your knees would have tiny, painful divots in them for hours after. My grandmother walked past the corner and threw a handful of rice on the floor just as I stepped into the angle. "Kneel there until I tell you to get up." I didn't look at her, but I could sense how elevated her highbrows were. Not a word from me. I knelt, arms crossed, surreptitiously massaging my lacerated knuckles, which throbbed and distracted me from the rice that was boring into my bare knees. Maybe I was supposed to think about the morality of stealing, the crime of it. Maybe I was supposed to fear the punishment so much that I would never steal again. The truth, though, is that I ended up thinking about why we couldn't spare 25 cents for the trading cards and how to avoid getting caught if or when I stole something again. If I doubted whether we were poor, I knew it now, beaten sore by the reality of it. I didn't think about the abstractions of crime and punishment. I thought about the concrete realities of cause and effect. I got caught, and I got punished. I stole cards because we didn't have the money to buy the cards. I had asked to buy something often enough to know that the answer was always no. Poverty. Was that the crime? Poverty is no crime. Dostoevsky writes this phrase twice in Crime and Punishment. Crime is a symptom of poverty. Poverty is the real evil. I'd like to think that our poverty was what precipitated my crime. Maybe it did. But maybe it was the feeble morality of a six-year-old. Because what six-year-old can do the right thing when faced with Star Wars trading cards? I knelt for an hour in the corner, grains of rice stabbing into my knees, knuckles bloodied, wishing that we had had the money to buy the trading cards. I didn't hate Moai, and I didn't hate being caught for stealing. I hated the crime of being poor. May 1980. Tim, Helen, Lori, and my cousins Anne and Tien gathered with me, spellbound, in a circle, speechless, awestruck. Lou came running to see what all the excitement was about. In the middle of our assembly, a majestic black crow stood, its left wing hanging open and limp. The rest of its sleek, sylph-like body sharply contrasted the jagged angle of its broken wing and its stray feathers jutting out like black claws scraped on the pavement. The crow cawed intermittently, keeping us at bay, as though this mob of small humans intended to kill it. In fact, we were delighted to see such a large bird up close. Amid cries of, "What should we do?" and "Give it some room!" and "Don't scare it!" we kept the crow penned in as it hopped around in an elliptical orbit. After a few minutes, it wearied, sat motionless, and squawked weakly. My cousin Tien suggested that she get her dad, Juhu, and we all agreed that this was a good idea. Tien's dad could help the crow, and they lived just four doors down from us in the Colonial Square complex. Juhu, small, sinewy, muscular, always with a joke and a jaunty step, a smile as wide as his teeth were irregular, a glint in his eye, and a plan for something better. If we made a snow fort, he made it bigger. If we were riding bikes, he'd show us how to power slide. Juhu took everything to the next level. He came outside, his flip-flops clapping as he padded over to the scene with a wide smile and a cocksure stride, Tien bouncing alongside him. More neighborhood kids had come out, and a few other kids who had passed by stopped to admire the crow. "What's going on over here?" He rubbed his forearms as if he were about to wrench something loose. "The crow's hurt. Look at its wing." Different kids called out various ideas, a geyser of the good, the bad, and the ridiculous. "Take it to the doctors. Someone get a bandage. Let's take it inside. We can keep it as a pet." None of us thought past our initial suggestions. The crow was hurt, and we wanted to help it, wanted to do something. Something seemed better than nothing. Walking slowly toward it, Juhu sidled through our perimeter. He bent himself at the waist, and the crow, which now called and croaked more loudly, hopped around but remained corralled by us kids, who stood fast. Juhu made a soothing shush as he knelt even lower and closer to the crow. It stopped flapping and made a few small croaks as he picked it up gingerly. In the hands of an adult, the crow seemed even more magnificent and mysterious. Its body stretched the length of Chu's forearm, striking a regal profile with its deep black and purple against his white tank top. It hardly struggled as it was cradled in his arms. Shh. Shh. It settled with his soothing susurrations. Lu was particularly agitated. What's he going to do with the bird? He'll help it, don't worry. Maybe he'll take it to the doctor. I assured Lu even as I privately questioned my own confidence in Juhu. Chu gently held the crow out in front of him and tipped it lovingly from side to side, eyeing it. Was the other wing broken? Was it just the left wing? How could he fix it? We had seen Chu repair all things mechanical, and we believed that he would find a way to do the same for the crow. The tenderness with which he cradled it affirmed our hopes. He's definitely going to help it, we chattered to one another. He started walking away with the crow, and our circle parted for him and the bird as we fell in line behind them. He led the way, holding it in front of his body, both hands extended. The ensemble painted a peculiar scene. A diminutive Vietnamese man in flip-flops and cut-off jeans walking slowly up a grassy hill, holding a shadowy crow in his hands, while a dozen kids paraded slowly behind him, excitedly calling out different remedies. It was a beautiful day in the neighborhood. Our optimism floated in the air around us as we promenaded behind him. A few kids were trying to name it, humanize it, empathize with it. His name is Mr. Feathers. We followed Ju to the dumpsters of the apartment complex. Why are we at the dumpsters? Lu wondered aloud. The dumpsters were closed in by weathered stockade fencing, marking off a square area that hid six large metal garbage bins. Juhu, silent other than the soft clapping of his flip-flops, stepped up to the dumpster area and asked one of us to open the gate. Tim, still my best friend in the neighborhood, hurried over and clacked it open. We stood around the yawning gate in a wide half-circle, wondering how Juhu was going to fix the crow in the dumpsters. Maybe the dumpster was a quieter place for the crow. Maybe it would feel less agitated with fewer people around. It definitely seemed less agitated. Juhu lowered the crow over the edge of the nearest green dumpster. It flapped its right wing as it slid down. I could see the quick goodbyes of a black wing, and I saw nothing more. Its squawks and caws echoed from the bottom, and we could all hear the rustling of trash as the crow hopped from bag to bag. Among the semicircle, we stopped talking and looked on, mute with curiosity. None of us knew how to help a crow, and we wouldn't have chosen the dumpster as a place to do it, but what did we know? Nothing, apparently. What did we expect? Something, apparently. Juhu picked up a yard-long metal pipe about 2 inches in diameter that was propped up against the dumpster, detritus from a plumbing repair job in one of the apartment units. The edge of the dumpster was as high as his shoulders, so he stood on his tiptoes to leverage his arms over the edge, his flip-flops drawn away from his heels. His hands gripped the top of the pipe, holding it vertically over his head as though he were operating a giant invisible butter churn. His arms formed a sharp triangle over his shoulders. Someone shushed the chatter in the back. Stillness. What did we expect? Juhu stabbed the pipe straight down as hard as he could, and we heard the popping of garbage bags as the pipe pounded the bottom of the dumpster. Why was he popping the garbage bags? Bang! 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 Muffled in the banging and popping, a gurgling squawk was heard. The smell of putrid garbage and rot circulated, making some kids cover their noses and gag. A few kids cried out in surprise at the first blows. Oh no! No! Juhu raised his arms up and down several more times, whacking around the dumpster, knifing downward left and right. Bang! 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 His toes shifted and his triceps flexed as he sidled quickly along the edge of the dumpster, shifting one way, then sliding another way along the edge. I saw by his movements that the crow was trying to dodge the pipe. We heard the crow, still thrashing atop the bags. Bang! 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 The squawking stopped after the third series of blows. The last caw sounded distant and wet. He dropped the pipe in the bottom of the dumpster and it clanged a hollow, final peal. He closed the gate, wiped his hands on his cut-off shorts, and plodded down the hill toward the parking lot, silent. In his wake, half of the kids were crying because of what they saw, and the other half were still trying to figure out what they had just seen. I was in the latter, lingering behind. Some kids ran home in tears as others stood around, bewildered. No one wanted to play tag or kickball, not after what we had witnessed. Our afternoon had spiraled from our idealistic pipe dream of saving the crow to its blunt bludgeoning in the dumpster. We were the witnesses to the murder, powerless to stop it, victims of the spectacle. I meandered with Lou down the hill. What had I expected? Juhu had done what he thought was the right thing, and in his estimation, killing the crow was the kindest act he could bestow upon it. Clapping his hands together, wiping off the grit of the pipe, he went inside his apartment. The door clicked shut. He'd killed the crow with the banal ease of taking out the trash. As I got to the parking lot of our complex, I saw Mawai coming over for a visit. She waved to me and Lou, her highbrows in good spirits. She smiled and called for us to come over, hugging us both. Her perfume wafted the scent of peonies. My knuckles were still healing from the scissors. Bawai, my grandmother, gentle one moment, violent in the next. Violence was sometimes kindness, sometimes it was love, sometimes it was rage, but it was everywhere, always. Chapter 3. The Scarlet Letter. October 1980. Tag, you're it! I fell forward hard from the unseen blow that struck me square between the shoulders. I'm not even playing, I yelled. I picked the loose gravel out from my reddened palms as I looked up to see Derek Elkins running away. Doesn't matter if you're playing, you're it! Fuchs it, everybody! Fuchs it! The kids who were playing tag flew in every direction. I'm not even playing! I went to the swings to look for Craig Fleckman and our X-Wing squadron. I hopped on board a swing, and we took flight as Derek intruded into our airspace. He stood in front of us as we swung inches from his nose. You're still it! He mocked me from below, sticking his tongue out. Derek spearheaded the reassembling group of kids. I said I'm not playing! I was too busy trying to destroy the Empire. Derek made his eyes into slants, fingers in the outer corners. Nyah, nyah, you can't even catch me. I ignored it. Big deal. My eyes were shaped different. Words were meaningless. We were at a deadlock, but the group consensus declared that I was it. That was how democracy worked, how the mob ruled. Their game needed an it, and no one wanted to be it. That language itself, being it, was our first exercise in dehumanization. It starts early. When you play tag, you're not a person. You're a thing, an it. In the English language, we deploy that gender at an early age to create an it, an other, to dehumanize, to flee, to amuse. Find someone else! With his eyes still finger-creased, Derek tried to provoke me to catch him. You can't even catch me. Can't catch me. Can't catch me. You're just a stupid gook. A gook. What was that? I didn't know what that word meant, but I knew enough to read the crowd. Grace, Katie, John, they all froze. Their eyes widened. Disbelief. Alarm. Liza Lyons upbraided Derek. You can't say that, Derek. That's a really bad word. I didn't know any bad words besides various combinations of stupid, dumb, poop, with the suffix head, but this word gook seemed like it needed a response based on Liza's reaction. If it were a truly bad word, it needed a truly strong retort. Derek persisted. Well, he's it, and he is a gook. That's what my parents said. So he's it. The game had changed. It wasn't tag anymore. I leapt off my X-swing and ran toward Derek. None of the kids scattered as Derek turned to run from me. I hammered him 3 times, and his nose immediately gushed crimson as he fell to the ground. His front teeth cut into my knuckles, and my hand stung from the blow. I stood, tears streaming down my face. Why was I crying? When I felt an iron hand clamp down around my arm. It was Mrs. Boos. Mrs. Boos was our second grade teacher. Sporting a short, sandy bouffant that looked more helmet than hairstyle, Mrs. Boos was a brawny woman who was just as comfortable splitting logs as she was hewing second graders. She pulled us asunder. "What's going on here?" Derek whimpered, staring at the blood sprayed all over his yellow Mork and Mindy iron-on t-shirt. The game was over, and Derek, the shock wearing off, was furious. "Fook hit me! He hit me!" Mrs. Boos glared at me as her vice tightened on my arm. Per her schoolyard forensics, Mrs. Boos was asking questions of the who hit whom first variety, reconstructing the crime scene. "Why did you hit him, Fook?" Without the wisdom of legal counsel or the reading of my Miranda rights, I offered the provocation. "Well, Derek called me a gook. A gook!" I said it twice, hoping that it would be grounds for my acquittal. To my own surprise, I started to cry again. Humiliated, I couldn't look at all the kids who were still standing around us. I fastened my gaze only on Mrs. Boos. She was silent, and a frown flickered across her face. Her wattles tightening, her glasses twitched as she focused on me. "Well? Well, you don't even know what that word means, do you? And besides, we don't hit other people. You know what we say. Sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me." The playground bell gaveled our due process over with the end of recess. "Everyone line up to go inside. We'll get Derek cleaned up. And Fook, remember, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me." She raised her voice so that everyone in the line could hear, a convenient PSA to us all. To the astonishment of all involved, especially me, nothing came of the fight. I was not sent to the principal's office, nor was I paddled by Mr. Van Zant, and in the judicial system of second grade, Mrs. Boos sent an unspoken but resounding message. There were some transgressions for which you could punch someone with impunity. Apparently, calling someone a gook was one of them. And apparently, I was one of them. Whether I liked it or not, I was it. And I wasn't even playing, was I? Do we want words to be powerful or powerless? We can't have it both ways. If we want them to be powerful, we have to act and speak accordingly, handling our words with the fastidious faith that they can do immeasurable good or irreparable harm. But if we want to say whatever we want, if we want to loose whatever words fly into our minds, then we render words powerless, ineffectual, and meaningless, like the playground bromide of sticks and stones. That childhood logic leads you to believe that suffering corporal trauma is worse than verbal trauma. Nathaniel Hawthorne would beg to differ. When I read Scarlet Letter for the first time in high school, it dawned on me how ridiculous Hester Prynne's punishment is for having an extramarital affair and a child out of wedlock. "Oh, hey, we're gonna sew a giant red letter A on you." The teenage snark in me said, "Yeah, right. Why not just tear the letter off, wear a t-shirt over it, or move to another town?" I couldn't fathom how one letter of the alphabet could destroy a person's existence. But in the olden golden days of colonial Massachusetts, it was a serious sentence. Public humiliation was tantamount to a death sentence because you were torn from the social fabric of the colony. Nathaniel Hawthorne understood that language is a social contract. We all agree that dog means dog and cat means cat. In that simple agreement, we are bound together, and it's the currency of our transactions. Hester honors that contract by staying in the colony where everyone knows what her transgressions are and what the A stands for. Spoiler alert, it's for adultery. She consents to being publicly shamed. She stays at the colony because it's where she has a powerful, albeit negative, identity. And from that robust identity comes her purpose and meaning. Hester chooses to stay where she is Hester. Even without knowing what the word gook meant, I was binding myself to the social contract of language, and in doing so, I allowed myself to be harmed by it. I was giving the word power. I could have ignored it or allowed my ignorance to shield myself, but that very ignorance would have further isolated me and, ultimately, dehumanized me. And that was the game of it: ostracize and dehumanize. But If I allowed myself to be harmed by words, I was showing them that I belonged at least by virtue of understanding their language. And all I wanted was to belong. My mother had left the apple orchard and gotten a better paying job at McCoy Electronics, a circuit board factory. She worked the day shift on the soldering line, and my father arranged to work third shift and be home during the day in the summertime. With the hope of connecting his children to Vietnam, he decided to use that time to teach me to read Vietnamese, as I was reading in English now. Lou was luckily still illiterate in both languages. My father and I sat at the kitchen table, just the two of us. In front of us lay a primer for Vietnamese, a thin paperback booklet with simple line drawings of kids and animals and single words. Say it again. This mark means the downward tone. This mark means the upward tone. Read it again. The spelling didn't make sense to me. I kept pronouncing the D as it was pronounced in English, a voiced alveolar stop for you phonologists in the audience. No, that's not how you say it. D is pronounced like Y. Right then, I decided that Vietnamese was a stupid language, or at least its alphabet was stupid. D pronounced like Y? No thank do. I heard Lou playing with Tim and other neighborhood kids outside. They were running around, throwing rocks and digging holes, having adventures without me. I shrunk low in my chair and scowled at the page. There weren't even sentences to read, just the musical notations of the six different tones. Uptone, downtone, higher tone, no tone, up-down tone, question tone. I said, yeah, wrong. No, you're not trying. Do it again. I said, yeah, wrong again. Again. Wrong. Again. Wrong. My father struck the table with his fist. Tears streaked my face. How are you going to read Vietnamese? Are you going to be a Vietnamese person who can't read their own language? The rhetorical answer was yes, but my father's question implied a deeper logic. If I chose not to learn to read it, did that make me less Vietnamese? And if so, did that mean that I could be more of something else? If I read English better, did that mean that I could be more American? Already the answer seemed obvious to me. I wanted to be more American, to fit in. I didn't want to be more Vietnamese. Vietnamese got me teased. Vietnamese got me into fights. Vietnamese meant not American. A gook. My father limped through a few more weeks of instruction, but his efforts did not budge my tight-jawed recalcitrance. I had made up my mind that I was not going to learn to read Vietnamese, that it was a waste of my efforts. And so I sat saturnine at the table, willfully unteachable. No amount of spanking or punishment was going to sway me. Kids covet things. They see something that other kids have, and they want that thing. They see a cool t-shirt with Darth Vader on it, and they want that shirt too. Soon, they want the house, the hair, the skin color. I wanted to be Ethan Alder. Ethan was popular. Ethan was tall, blonde, athletic, charismatic. He was the first kid who was cool, which meant that he didn't care. He didn't care that he was bad at reading or that he was being sent to Mr. Van Zandt's office, and he certainly didn't care that we all thought he was cool. Ethan wore distinctive Bjorn Borg-style wristbands, white terry cloth with red and blue stripes. With his insouciance, he looked perpetually ready to serve an ace shot. I wanted Ethan Alder's wristbands. Ethan and I weren't friends. I was still playing Star Wars with Craig Fleckman on the playground. However, I started to realize that Craig and I were the only ones who played with each other. Craig was tall and rangy. He laughed at the wrong time in story circle and would tease girls. But Ethan, on the other hand, didn't participate in the imaginary heroics of recess. He was the Achilles of wall ball. Boys lined up to challenge him only to be vanquished. Girls flocked around him at the end of every recess. He was sweaty, but I swore he sparkled. Being Ethan was an impossible aspiration, and I decided that the next best thing was to look like him. And to look like Ethan Alder, I had to have Bjorn Borg wristbands. One Sunday afternoon at Woolco, as I wandered the department store aisles. I found wristbands. Eureka! I might as well have discovered solid gold bullions. I clutched the wristbands, triumphant, and ran to my mother. Ma, ma, can I have these? I want these. My mother looked at them and flipped them over. She couldn't make sense of what they were possibly for. What are they? They're wristbands. They're for your wrists. You wear them. Wristbands? What for? Are they like gloves? I don't know. But can I have them? No, you can't. No wristbands. I didn't ask why. I knew that my parents calculated the family's monthly budget weekly, if not daily. I pictured my father at the kitchen table, bills in one pile, pencil and notebook in another. We had recently stopped taking hand-me-downs from our sponsors, a proud day for my parents. While rebuilding their lives, they were piecing together their pride, the blocks of their self-esteem mortared together with self-sufficiency and independence. We didn't need free clothes anymore, and even if we didn't wear the finest clothing, the clothes that we did wear, we bought for ourselves. There was no extra money for the wristbands. I didn't even know what wristbands were used for, but I knew exactly what I would use them for, to look like Ethan Alder. And being more like him meant being less like myself. But we went home with new socks and no wristbands. That evening, I closed my bedroom door behind me as my brother watched television in the living room and my mother made dinner. Scissors in hand, I rummaged through my drawers and pulled out a pair of new athletic tube socks, pearly white, with striped scarlet bands at the top. I flipped them inside out and saw that their fuzzy interior looked like loops of terry cloth. The scissors clacked the elastic tube tops from the footlets. If the boy couldn't have wristbands, then the boy would make wristbands out of athletic tube socks with scissors. See you later, socks. Hello, wristbands. I tucked my wristbands into my backpack, ready for their runway debut. That Monday morning, amid the bustle and rustle of backpacks and lunchboxes, the squeaks of chairs and flip-up desktops, I reached into my backpack and slipped on my wristbands, aka my decapitated tube socks turned inside out. They looked exactly like Ethan Alder's. I eyed his Bjorn Borgs from across the room as he gesticulated wildly about something cool. I looked just like him now. It was a proud new day. I played it cool, not drawing attention to myself, but looking around to see if anyone noticed my new accessories. Craig looked at them, but didn't say anything. I didn't see this as a setback because Craig didn't notice a lot of things. He was still sneaking paste under his desk and eating it, which he had been doing since kindergarten. As we lined up for the first recess of the day, I positioned myself behind Ethan. No one had said anything all morning, and I realized that I was going to have to seize the day, because the day was passing by without any acknowledgement. Hey, Ethan, look. I held up my wrists. Wristbands. I said it just in case it wasn't obvious to him that he and I were the same. He eyed my wristbands suspiciously. Those aren't wristbands. What are those? Grace Hazelwood, who stood behind me, butted into the conversation. Are those socks? They are socks. She and Ethan giggled as the recess line processed outside. Those are socks. Oh my God, Fook is wearing socks on his wrists. As soon as we got outside, I distanced myself from them, even as I heard them sniggering on their way to the wall ball area. My mind began a furious debate. Should I take them off? I wondered. Leave them on? Give them the satisfaction of humiliating me or persevere? I decided that I would show them. The wristbands stayed on. I kept the dismembered socks on all day, enduring taunts until the novelty of it wore off. Craig, in true friend fashion, said nothing. That was the extent of his friendship, not participating in sock mocking. A neutrality that was good enough for me. After school, Lou and I played outside until my parents called us in for dinner by yelling out the window for us as they always did. We bolted in and up the stairs, sliding across our chairs to bowls of rice and stir-fried vegetables. A heap of rice was half in my mouth when my mother noticed my wristbands. I had forgotten to take them off. What are those? I didn't buy wristbands. Whose are those? Did you cut your socks up? Did you cut up perfectly good socks? My mother kept yelling as she pulled me from my seat to confirm her suspicions, but my father didn't wait for the results of her inspection. The mere accusation that I had cut up brand new socks was enough for him, and his hand struck my rear with several sharp blows. My mother provided the blistering soundtrack to my father's assault as I ran off to my room mid-dinner. We just spent money on those socks, brand new socks, and now you cut them up? Are you a fool? Do you think we're making so much money that you can do that? Why don't you just throw money away? No more wristbands, no more scissors. Lesson learned. Humiliated at school, beaten at home. The wristbands had not been worth the risk. My father's rage would erupt in primal and unpredictable ways. Our spankings, beatings in fact, were regular and, as I later realized, vicious. It was not until my adulthood that I understand his abusive behavior. As an adult, I can explain and even understand where his anger came from. PTSD as a refugee, his own abuse as a child, the cycle of abuse that can perpetuate itself in a culture that equated obedient children with great parenting. As a second grader, I knew this violence as my only reality. If I spilled something, disobeyed, did something too quickly or too slowly, the violence that pelted me bore no morality or judgment, amassing like storm clouds that darken the sky, only to disperse in vapors. My mother would warn me, "Wait until your father gets home," and I would go into my room so I could put on two pairs of underwear in preparation, in the hopes that two pairs of my favorite Spider-Man underoos would deflect the blows and deafen the bellows. But did my uncouth behavior merit beatings? I was a sassy, mouthy, overly energetic kid, always on the go, always talking. My report cards regularly said, "Talks too much." Infractions of all sorts precipitated a variety of punishments. Sometimes it was a slap on the ass. Sometimes it was the old kneeling in a corner on uncooked rice. And other times, it was being beaten by whatever my parents could get their hands on. Brutality bore ingenuity. That fall of second grade, however, I received a beating that eclipsed all others, so savage that I don't remember what it was for. I could make something up, but to what end? Would the cause matter or somehow justify it? My father had started using a metal rod that he brought home from the tire factory. He couldn't hit me as hard with his hand anymore. The manual spankings had stopped hurting me, and even a wooden spoon did not inflict enough pain. Hence, the metal rod, dark gray and about the length of a yardstick, pitted with bits of ready corrosion. The rod was a piece of machinery that had been thrown away, and my father, eyeing it in the scrap heap, immediately saw its domestic potential. The rod was more efficient because it hurt more, and as a result, it required less effort while achieving maximum results. American efficiency? Meet Vietnamese ingenuity. With the metal rod, two or three cracks across our buttocks or the back of our thighs sufficed. Message received, loud and clear. In that particular incident, however, I was beaten with the rod across the rear end and legs with a dozen or so blows. I remember crying into the floral velour pattern of our brown couch and hearing my father counting off the blows. He counted upward from one, so I never knew when he would stop. Mulp. Hi. Ba. Bom. Nam. Sao. Bay. Tam. Chin. Mui. 10. I lost count after mui. What I also remember vividly was that I was not able to sit down the next day. I could barely move my legs to get dressed the next morning. My hamstrings and butt were so ravaged. My aching thighs carried me to school, slowly, and the neighborhood kids ran ahead while I trudged along, falling behind. In class, when the Pledge of Allegiance ended, we pulled out our chairs to begin our schoolwork. The chairs and chair backs were hard plywood riveted to gray steel legs. Everyone assumed their positions, but I couldn't bear the touch of the seat on my rear, so I stood at my desk, leaning over my worksheet. "Fook, you need to sit," Mrs. Booth directed. "Okay," I said as I put my feet on my chair and crouched with my butt hovering over the seat. She walked around the room to check our spelling worksheets, circling back to my cluster of desks, and she saw me squatting in my chair. "You need to sit down," she said. "I know, I'm sorry, Mrs. Boose." She walked away to another group of kids as I sat cross-legged on my shins with my feet underneath me, but that still hurt too much. I was still hovering on my knees, shifting from leg to leg, fidgeting. Mrs. Boose came back to my desk. "Fook, do you need to go to Mr. Van Zandt's office?" "No, Mrs. Boose, I'll try to sit. I'm sorry." I pretended to sit, floating over my seat, putting my weight on my forearms. My seat might as well have been a bed of nails, given the way it needled my backside. The squat made my thighs burn, so I stood again. Mrs. Boose saw me, and her thin lips quivered. Her voice had a tautness, trebled with aggravation. "Okay, Fook, you need to come up here and see me right now at my desk." I stood straight and pushed my chair in before limping toward the front of the room. The kids at my desk group had stopped their writing exercises and watched me walking toward Mrs. Boose. She smelled like old Christmas candy and sweat. My face smoldered flush and hot. I dreaded getting sent to the principal's office because my parents would find out, and then there would be another beating. Or even worse, what if I got paddled at Mr. Van Zandt's office? I could barely walk as it was. And I would get spanked at home again. The thought of my father thrashing my already swollen backside was unbearable. I had been beaten as much as I could physically bear, and the prospect that I might get paddled, beaten, or spanked again cracked the fragile shell of my composure. When I was within arm's reach of her, Mrs. Boose sat in her chair and swiveled it so that we were square to each other. "Fook, why are you disobeying me? Why are you refusing to sit in your seat? I think you're going to need to go to Mr. Van Zandt's office." My face burned even hotter, and I disintegrated. My pain, humiliation, and fear of further reprisal ruptured, exploding into sobs of agony and trepidation. I found myself weeping in front of the classroom, telling Mrs. Boose why I couldn't sit, leaning forward and hiding my wet face in her stale hair. I blocked out my classmates while I cried, locking my attention on Mrs. Boose and the immediate consequences. I told her that my father had beaten me the night before and that my legs and back were too sore to sit. I told her about the metal rod. I blew my nose and wiped my face on my sleeve. She listened intently. Her face softened and she leaned forward. "Go back to your seat and do the best you can. Thanks for telling me about what was hurting you." I walked back to my desk, holding my eyes fast to the floor, stinging from the degradation of crying in front of my classmates. But I just wanted things to go back to normal, so I busied myself with my worksheet. The rest of the day was a blur while I stood at my desk awkwardly for the remainder of school, trying to focus and pretending that my class hadn't witnessed me sobbing. Recess was painful, as was the walk home. It turned out that sticks and stones did hurt. So did words and metal rods. Everything hurt. That night, my parents answered a phone call from Mrs. Boose. She wanted to visit us at home and talk to them. I fretted over the intent and outcome of her visit, uncertain about what she might say or do. My father ruled our household with an iron rod. This was how he compelled order, discipline, compliance. In my childish logic, if my mother were stronger than my father, her will would have been the way of our home. If I were stronger than my father, I could have imposed my will upon him, just as I physically prevailed upon my little brother with farts on his head, punches in the arm, shoves and noogies. Might made right under our roof, and Mrs. Boose would not be able to assert herself physically. No good would come of her visit for me. I was sure of that. I anticipated a beating immediately after her visit, since my father instantly asked me why she was coming over and if I had misbehaved at school. I told him that I didn't know and neglected to tell him about my confession to her. The next day, after school, Mrs. Boose's yellow Mercury pulled into the parking lot of our apartment complex. I had been watching for it all afternoon since I had gotten home. In her mustard overcoat and a flowered scarf, she swayed back and forth, scanning for our apartment number before she headed toward our front door. She did not walk like a woman who was ready for a fight. She dressed as she did for school, wearing polyester floral, gold necklaces, helmet hair, and rogue lipstick that went a little farther than her lips actually were. The doorbell rang, and my brother and I sat while my parents let her in. Thank you for giving me a few minutes of your time, Mr. and Mrs. Tran. It won't be long. They offered her water or tea, which she declined. It's nice to see you. Fook, would you and your brother wait in your bedroom? Sequestered from the adults, Lou pushed a matchbox car around on the carpet, but I didn't want to play with our toys. Huddled against the door, I parsed the muted murmuring of their adult speak, noting the change in tone of different speakers. I didn't hear my mother and presumed that she yielded her minutes to my father. No yelling, no fighting. I didn't hear any sign of a match of physical strength. My father did not wield the iron rod, and their talk seemed to end amicably. After several minutes, our bedroom door opened, and my brother and I came out to say goodbye to Mrs. Boos. I'll see you tomorrow, Fook. Thank you for your time, Mr. and Mrs. Tran. She lumbered out and into her car, leaving a faint smell of her candied perfume in the room. Her arrival and departure felt even more mysterious because of its calm. I didn't want to ask, but was unable to quell my interest. What did Mrs. Boos talk with you about? I interrupted my parents Vietnamesing with each other quietly. Am I in trouble? I anticipated another spanking. No, you're not in trouble, my father intoned flatly. I was amazed to hear his reply. So why was Mrs. Boos here? She said that she learned that I was spanking you a lot. She said that you couldn't sit at school because your legs hurt so much. Mrs. Boos said that here, in America, parents can't hit their kids as much as they do in Vietnam. He didn't go so far as to say that he wouldn't spank me. I was surprised to hear Mrs. Boos's message to my parents, particularly since Mr. Van Zandt, our principal, paddled kids in his office all the time. And by paddling, I mean beating kids with a wooden oar. What was the distinction between beating kids with a wooden oar and beating kids with a metal rod? More frightened than relieved, I reiterated, "So I'm not in trouble?" "No, you're not." I nodded and went back to my room, unsure of what the ramifications of Mrs. Boos's intervention were. I didn't dare to hope for the beatings to cease. I had already hoped for that before, only to be sorely disappointed. I assumed that the worst outcome would be that nothing would change. That was the wildest hope that I allowed to flutter free in my mind, that things would stay the same. But they didn't. My father didn't beat me that week, nor the next week, and he didn't beat me for the rest of that school year. It was a long reprieve for me, and I was thankful for it. Thankful for Mrs. Boos and for her words. Maybe words were powerful, maybe even magical. Derek hadn't called me a gook since we'd gotten into the fist fight, but I was still the bullseye of his schoolyard taunts. During recess, when we were free to fly, I escaped his focus, running as far and as fast as my X-wing legs carried me. I was most exposed and vulnerable when we lined up for the beginning and end of recess, and in the line I couldn't put enough distance between myself and Derek and his coffle of lunkheads. One day, Derek slithered up, two kids behind me. Caught in the line, I was trapped, wriggling and writhing, gasping to get away. "Hey, Fook, why is your nose so flat? Did you guys ever notice how flat his nose is?" Laughter, humiliation. Words still hurt me, but at least he didn't call me a gook. Even Craig was laughing, my Chewbacca. There's betrayal, and there's the stinging betrayal by your loyal Wookiee friend. Karen Larkin, who had never participated in any taunting, was next to Derek and jumped in too. I didn't blame her. The train of second grade taunts was always on the express route, and if you didn't get on board, you got run over. "Yeah, why is your nose so flat?" Immediately, I fired back. "Oh, when I was a baby, I got run over by a bus in Vietnam. And then, squish, my nose got flattened." Karen's eyes saucered wide. "What?" "Yep, a bus went right over my nose. Just like this." I smacked my hand against my face, hard, mimicking Curly from the Three Stooges. And then the laughter pivoted. Grace was laughing with me. Craig laughed too. My joke was the proverbial and metaphorical bus under which I had thrown myself. Just for emphasis, I had hit my own face for laughs, a gesture of things to come. At least everyone was laughing with me, and I didn't have to punch anyone. I preferred laughter with me more than at me. That was the power of prepositions. As the line processed inside, Derek hissed from behind me. You're still a gook. I don't care what you say. Still a gook. And he was right. I couldn't change his mind about that. I wielded no control over how he saw me. I would always be a gook to him. That I couldn't take off. G was my scarlet letter. November 1980. The first week of November, as the Halloween skulls, hissing cats, and green-warded witches came down from the walls of the classroom, Mrs. Boos announced the Thanksgiving Writing Contest. The school-wide competition was to write and illustrate a sentence about what you were thankful for, and each grade would have one winner chosen. The five winners would get to have lunch with Mr. Van Zandt, and the lunch was no ordinary lunch. Mr. Van Zandt took all the kids, in his own car, through the McDonald's drive-thru for Happy Meals, and then they all returned to Mr. Van Zandt's office to eat their Happy Meals. This was an annual tradition, and we all knew other kids who had won and come back to tell the tale from the luncheon. The fabled golden arches, hot French fries, a milkshake. For those of us whose parents seldom bought fast food, the McDonald's prize luncheon for the Thanksgiving contest was the gold standard of prizes. On contest day, Mrs. Boos handed out beige composition paper. She was sweatier than usual as she circled the room, squawking out the instructions. "Okay, class, please write a sentence and draw a picture of what you are thankful for. Remember, the teachers will be getting together to look at all the drawings and will pick one winner from each grade. And as you remember, the winner will be having a McDonald's lunch with Mr. Van Zandt." The class scribbled furiously for what felt like an hour. I spied elaborate compositions, flourishes of loop-the-loop clouds, saltbox houses with lemon-yellow suns shining down. At the end of the allotted time, Mrs. Boos collected our papers and tacked them to the bulletin board at the front of the room. I handed in my drawing, and as I looked at my classmates' illustrations,